Hello, Indiana 4-H, and welcome to The 4th H. The 4th H is a healthy living podcast series that aims to bring a renewed energy and focus to the 4th H in Indiana 4-H. My name is Angie Frost, and I am a Purdue University 4-H Extension Specialist and a registered dietitian. The 4th H podcasts provide us an opportunity to discuss various aspects of nutrition, physical activity, and social-emotional health. So, as we pledge our health to better living, let's get started. I'd like to begin this podcast by having you think about the following questions. Have you ever known a child who received free or reduced-priced meals at school, or a family who received food stamps? Have you ever volunteered at a food pantry, soup kitchen, or community garden? Have you ever been a recipient of food from one of these places? And have you ever thought about how you can get involved to make a difference in your community? On today's podcast, we will discuss food insecurity and hunger, how these affect children and adults long-term, Purdue Extension's role in helping alleviate these issues, and ways to get involved and make a difference. Today I'm joined by Melissa Malding and Steve McKinley. Melissa is the Director of the Nutrition Education Program for Purdue Extension and a registered dietitian, and Steve is a 4-H Extension Specialist working in the areas of leadership and volunteerism. Welcome to you both. It's wonderful to have both of you with us today. Melissa, why don't we begin by having you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Angie, thanks for having me. Thanks for the invitation. So I'm a registered dietitian. I work as the director of the Nutrition Education Program, and in that work, we have the opportunity to address some of the things that we're talking about today, so I'm glad to be here and talk about that. When I'm not working, I get to do a lot of volunteer work with my church and my youth group and some counseling, and I also am working on a PhD at Indiana Wesleyan. So that takes a lot of time, and also, just, you know, historically, I was a 4-H member myself, 9 years, not quite 10, couldn't get mom and dad talked into that first year, but had a lot of great memories and know that it had a huge impact on where I'm at today.
Great. That's wonderful. I can't quite imagine working on a PhD and working full time. So kudos to you for all of that hard work and fitting volunteering into that as well. And we also have Steve McKinley with us. So, Steve, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Thank you, Angie. It's also good to be here today. So glad that you were able to invite me and looking forward to the opportunity to share a little bit about what I do. I am the Leadership Volunteerism Specialist for the Indiana 4-H Program and get to work with youth and adult audiences, both volunteer as well as paid staff in our extension offices, work with several different youth leadership conferences and help develop some volunteer resources as well as working with some staff development for our 4-H Extension educators across the state of Indiana. For me personally, I grew up in Indianapolis and was a 4-H member there before coming to Purdue to get my education, and I then went on to White County Extension Office to work as the 4-H Extension educator prior to joining my position here on campus in about 2004.
Wonderful. It's really nice to have two former 4-H members with us today. A little bit of additional knowledge. I hadn't realized that Melissa was a 4-H member, so that's great to have you both here today, especially to help us talk about this really important topic. So again, thank you both for joining us today to discuss this important topic of food insecurity and hunger. Melissa, what can you tell us about these two different terms? Is there a distinction? Are they different from each other?
You know, that's a really good question, Angie, and we talk a lot about that. You know, as the public, we don't necessarily use those terms interchangeably, or more often you hear the term hunger, but really they're very much the same. So as we think about hunger, oftentimes we have this picture in our mind of children with swollen bellies in faraway places. And while that may not be the circumstance that we face here in the United States with that level of extremity, we do have hunger and food insecurity. And so when we talk about food insecurity, it really boils down to, you know, Angie, when you go home tonight, you have food in your cabinet, and you know probably as a registered dietitian what you're going to make tonight. for some families, those some moms and dads go home and they don't have that food accessible to them. And so what that means then is that they're food insecure. They're unsure where their next meal is coming from for their family. And so with that insecurity, obviously there's hunger associated with that. They're similar and very much the same, but, you know, minutely different.
Okay, that's really interesting. It is hard for some of us to imagine not having any food in our cupboards or our refrigerator, and that definitely is happening. It's happening potentially next door to us. So this is definitely a topic that we do need to discuss and find ways to help our neighbors and our communities. So I'm sure that with this issue of hunger, there are some myths and misunderstandings that are associated with those who are living in poverty here in the United States. Can you address what some of those common myths are?
Yeah, that's a really good question as well. You know, people that use assistance programs like the Free and Reduced Lunch Program or WIC or SNAP, which is, I guess I should define those acronyms. So WIC is the Women's, Infants, and Children. It's a program that serves pregnant women and families that have children that are, I believe, 6 or younger. And then the SNAP program is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. It was once referred to as food stamps, so that's a more familiar term sometimes. But so back to your question, people that use these assistance programs are often misconstrued as being somehow lazy or not working. And so in fact, when we look at statistics in Indiana, the average length of time that an individual is on SNAP, for example, is about 12 months. Additionally, many of them are working, but because of the costs of living, which we can all associate with, those families still can't make ends meet. And so if you want to know a little bit more about that scenario, there are organizations in Indiana that are investigating those things. The term that you would want to look for is the living wage. And so the Center for Working Families does a lot of research around the living wage in Indiana. And they have a really helpful website if you want to dial in your county specifically. So Tippecanoe County or Boone County or whatever, you can find what the costs of living are and what it would take for a family to be what we would call self-sustaining in a way that wouldn't require them to have additional assistance to keep their families fed.
Okay, that's really interesting. And some of those myths, I think, have just stayed with us for such a long time. And I think that trying to debunk some of those myths and help people understand that many of these people are working and they do get up and go to work every day and have childcare still because they have families and they still are having trouble making enough to feed themselves and afford other things like medications and things like that. So thank you for sharing that website as well, where people can go and find out some additional information about their specific county. So speaking of counties, what does food insecurity look like in Tippecanoe and surrounding counties? What is the overall numbers and things like that?
Yeah. So just kind of to start off at a sort of personal or relational level, Angie, I mean, when you ask what does food insecurity look like, and you kind of referred to this in your intro, it probably looks like the student that's sitting next to you in class or the person that's sitting next to you at church or potentially your neighbor, depending on, you know, where you're at, where you're located. And so that's something that I think we have to think about initially before we even get into the statistics, is just that it's something that's affecting someone that you rub shoulders with. It's not something some far off somewhere, but it's right next door. So, and then statistically, if we take a look at some stats from Feeding America, 1.1 million people were served by food banks in Indiana in 2014. And if you're not familiar with what a food bank is, that's kind of like a hub. So you're probably familiar with little volunteer food pantries in your communities that may be in a church basement or some other sort of social caring agency. A food bank provides cheap food or inexpensive food to those small food pantries. So they're able to get large quantities and then parse it out to smaller groups at a cheaper rate. So 33% of those folks that I mentioned, the 1.1 million in Indiana, 33% of those were children, 13% were seniors, If you think about demographically, sometimes, again, back to your myth questions, we have some preconceived ideas demographically about who's using these services. 18% were Black, 4% were Latino, 71% were white. And then another interesting fact, just because we're here at Purdue, a lot of times people don't think about this, but 9% of those people were college students. So our college students are under some pressure and have some needs at times too.
That's really interesting. I was surprised to hear that number, 9% of college students. We think of college students as being these people who are, you know, in different circumstances, maybe more affluent because they're at college. But that's not the case for everyone. Not everyone lives in a residence hall where a meal plan is provided, money to be able to pay for that. And some live at home. And I know there are probably college students who don't have a home at all. They still are plugging away and trying to get their education to better themselves. So it's great that there are places they can go to be able to get the food that they need to be able to help them learn when they actually do go to class. So what type of circumstances often contribute to food insecurity? Is it just the loss of employment or not having employment?
You know, it could be a variety of things. Obviously, loss of employment is going to be a top one, but it can also be what we call underemployment. Again, kind of referring back to that living wage. If someone's making $10.50 an hour in most cases with children at home, that's not a sufficient salary to provide for their needs, for the costs of their living. In addition, you know, there are medical issues that come up and people are off work for those sorts of reasons, the short-term kind of scenarios. So there's a variety of different things that can affect why families have a need. In Tippecanoe County, for example, if we go back to those living wage sort of scenarios, it can be anywhere from $14 to $19 an hour that a family needs to make per adult if they have even one child in the family. Because you know this, daycare is expensive. You have a child that needs to go to the doctor, that has school expenses, all those sorts of things. A single adult could survive on minimum wage potentially in Tippecanoe County. But as soon as you enter children into the picture, those parents have to earn, again, $15 to $19 an hour to be self-sufficient.
Gosh, that's a much higher number than even I had expected. And I do know a little bit about food insecurity and hunger, but I'm still always surprised by some of the numbers when I hear them. And I think it is important to distinguish that term underemployment because, like we said earlier, many of these families are employed. They do have a job. They work full-time. Sometimes they work more than full-time. Sometimes they have two jobs, and they still are having trouble making ends meet, especially if those two jobs are paying in the $10 range. So very, very good to understand underemployment. When we talk about food insecurity and feeling hungry and those kind of things, how does that affect children? Are there long-term effects that go along with being chronically hungry?
As I think about who's listening to this podcast, I was kind of trying to think about how we'd answer that question. And if you're a student at school, I'm sure there are times when your mind wanders, right? I remember not that long ago that I was in school and getting yelled at by a teacher because I was gawking around or not paying attention to the lecture or whatever. So whenever you don't have those sort of anxieties about, if I go home tonight, mom's going to have food on the table. And if I go home tonight, there's going to be a place for me to go home and sleep, our minds still wander. But if you think about those 45% of SNAP recipients last year that were children, and the fact that oftentimes they're making choices, their families are making choices between paying for food and paying utilities. Statistics say 77% of SNAP eligible families are making that decision. Do I pay for food? Do I pay for transportation? Do I pay for food? Do I pay for medication? Do I pay for food? Do I pay for housing? Monthly, they're making those types of choices. And so if you're a child living in that sort of environment, think about the anxiety that creates and just the lack of security. They don't know when they go home if their landlord is going to have kicked them out of the latest apartment because they made that choice to pay for food instead of housing this month. They don't know if mom's already used her one trip to the food pantry this month so she can't make another meal at the end of the month. That's a really tough time for families that are struggling. And so that obviously leads to our minds wandering even more. Like, how can I concentrate on schoolwork when I've got bigger, much, much bigger issues at play in my life? And obviously, when we're malnourished or experiencing hunger, then there are health issues involved with that. And the mental anguish that is created as a result of that anxiety is also an issue involved. I mean, that's going to affect both adults and children.
Absolutely. And I had worked in a school environment for many years. And so many of the statistics that come along with being hungry in school show that there's more acting up in school when a child is hungry and can't focus on the lesson being taught. There are more visits to the nurse's office and the principal's office because of that acting up and just the general lack of being able to concentrate. And I think that that gets left out a lot when we're talking about achievement in school. I think that we give some face value to, oh, we know that there are kids that are hungry, but then we don't have many programs, or we don't have specific programs in place to help them make sure that they're fed all the time. There are some schools who have free breakfast for all students, whether they can afford to pay for it or not, which is amazing, because then any student can go in and have breakfast and get the school day started with a nourishing meal. And it also helps cut down on that stigma of school breakfast is only for those who are needy. It's for everybody. So hopefully there are more schools that are going to pick that up and be able to offer breakfast. So it is an issue to not know where your next meal is going to come from and try to focus in school. So this isn't just an adult issue. It's also a child issue. So we talked just a little bit there about that there are some free breakfasts and things like that that are offered in schools, but how else are these issues being addressed locally and across the state?
Yeah, so there are a variety of programs that we've mentioned already that are helping to reduce the barriers where food insecurity is concerned, and SNAP and WIC and the free and reduced lunch school lunch programs and breakfast programs are part of those. Something that's less familiar to most people are the summer feeding programs, because if you think about, we have a high percentage of students in our schools in the state that depend on the school lunch and breakfast programs. And so what happens to those kids when school's out? That program, the summer feeding program, schools and other community centers are able to provide a sort of similar lunch to a school lunch for students during the summer months. Food banks and food agents or food pantries are working to solve the problem. And then, you know, my staff, of course, for as part of the nutrition education program, we have community wellness coordinators that are working with schools and other agencies and entities within the community to try to address more issues at the community level where food security is concerned, whether that's helping to help civic organizations make more donations or plant community gardens that are meant for donation, working with schools to, as you mentioned earlier, decrease the stigma around accepting sort of the lunch programs and the breakfast programs. So those are some of the things that I'm most familiar with. I'm sure there are others that are going on in individual counties.
I'm really happy that you mentioned the summer feeding programs, because that is a wonderful opportunity for students who are able to have 1 to 2 warm meals a day throughout the school year, and then all of a sudden summer comes and there's nothing for them to eat. Those programs allow anyone up to the age of 18 to come into any school feeding program site. It doesn't have to be your own school. So if you happen to have family visiting and have extra children there and you're already unable to feed your own, then you can all pop in there. And adults can also pay for a meal for around $2 or $3. And it includes fruits and vegetables and whole grains and those kind of things. So it's a really good program. Another program that I'm aware of in schools is the backpack program. And the backpack program helps provide shelf-stable foods to students to take home over the weekend so that they have something to eat during the weekend. And that is a really good place for some civic agencies to get involved, because it is, there's an expense to filling up those backpacks. And for an individual, that might not be something that they can do, but for an agency, they can band together and come up with the funds to be able to support a backpack program for a school year. And that would be a really wonderful contribution. So thanks for that information. So earlier you had mentioned that you work with the SNAP Ed funded initiatives. Can you explain the SNAP program and discuss how Purdue Extension and your staff and some of your community partners are working to combat food insecurity and hunger?
Yeah, so the nutrition education program at Purdue is actually funded through both SNAP Ed, which is the education arm of SNAP, and FNAP, which is a really long title, but I'll give it to you, the Expanded Food and Nutrition Education Program. Both of those programs have existed in our state for quite some time. So those federal grant programs provide us the opportunity to support about 40 community wellness coordinators across the state and in the neighborhood of about 80 what we call nutrition education program assistants. So the nutrition education program assistants provide direct education. So we work in a variety of schools with high free and reduced lunch numbers to just provide basic nutrition and health education. And then for our adult clients, with those staff, we provide basic budgeting and food prep and food safety and those sorts of educational opportunities for them through curriculum that's been developed here at Purdue. The other group of our staff, the community wellness coordinators, generally speaking, are doing kind of two things. They're working to make sure that healthy food is easily accessible in limited resource communities to our limited resource clients, and also that what we call active living is accessible and possible for them. So active living doesn't necessarily relate to food security itself, but just for the good of the order. Ultimately, we want to make sure that folks have safe routes to school if they want to bike or walk, safe routes to walk, you know, just in neighborhoods with sidewalks, trails, whatnot, because we all can't afford a gym membership. So it's good for us to be able to be active outdoors or indoors in some inexpensive way. So, but back to the healthy access to healthy food. We do have documented food deserts in Indiana, which means it would take someone some significant resource via transportation to get somewhere, or there's a supermarket. In many of our rural areas specifically, we have a lot of, there are specific chains that are available, but then the food quality is limited. So there's lots of canned goods and that sort of thing, which are, you know, adequate. There's no access to fresh or frozen, and there's little access to a variety of food. We're doing things in communities to try to improve that variety and that access. So some of those things include, we've been working this past year in a pilot project with the Master Gardeners to plant donation gardens. And what happens as a result of that project, we donated about, I think it was in the neighborhood of almost 50,000 pounds of produce back to food pantries and caring organizations within four different counties, just to, again, increase the accessibility of healthy foods. So not only can you choose a can of green beans maybe now at some of those pantries, but also during the season, fresh green beans would be available. They're also working with school systems in large ways to improve the lunchroom scenario, whether it be, again, back to that stigma issue. How can we improve the policies around the free and reduced lunch program to kind of eliminate the separation? You know, when I was in school, there were pink lunch cards and yellow lunch cards, and you knew what those meant. If you were on a pink lunch card, you were on the free lunch program. And kids know that sort of stuff, and then they have the capacity to be cruel because they're unaware. Working with school systems to improve those policies that no one created as a means to hurt anyone, but just hadn't thought through those sort of implications. And then also, we've been working on food, what we call food rescue projects, which are very closely tied to food security. So if you've been in a school lunchroom lately and counted how many milks go in the trash because no one eats or drinks them, or string cheeses or individual applesauces or, you know, those sorts of things, whole apples. So in those food rescue projects, we provide resources to help the school donate that food. So they put up what they call a share table, and students who don't eat those things are able to put those items back on the share table, and then anyone in the classroom or in the lunchroom has access to those things that are on the share table. But then following, obviously, food safety guidelines, those things are stored and put away until a time when a caring agency or food pantry can retrieve those items. And so just for example, in Vanderburg County last year with one of our projects, the school donated over 4,000 cartons of milk to food pantries that would have been in the trash otherwise. So those sorts of things really cost very little to get going. It's really just volunteer time and volunteer effort. The food is there and would have been thrown away, or just repurposing it in a way that would improve food access and food security in those communities.
I really love that the schools are able to do that with the sharing tables and being able to donate that food that's not consumed so that it doesn't go to waste, for one thing, and so that someone else can benefit from it. And especially those things that require refrigeration. A lot of the smaller food pantries don't have refrigeration, and so milk is one of those things that families who are food insecure often don't get to have. And so I know that there has in the past been some real push towards providing gallons of milk from grocery stores through the Dairy Council, I believe, so that families can have that highly nutritious dairy product that the rest of us get to enjoy on a daily basis. So I really love that the schools are doing that and that the community wellness coordinators are working really hard to help bring food to the people who need it. So that's really eye-opening. So what are some practical steps that 4-H families and the youth that are participating in 4-H can take to address food insecurity in their own local communities?
So I think there's a variety of different things. I think the first thing starts really with just educating yourself on what your community's situation and scenario is. So oftentimes, those of us that don't face these issues firsthand on a daily basis may be unaware. So I would encourage you to find someone that can help educate you and your family on those things. And that could be my staff in your extension office or other extension staff that are working in those venues. Or it could be a variety of other different agencies and organizations that are working within your community. If it's your church's basement food pantry, for example. I mean, there's a variety of things that could help educate you. And then in terms of things that you could do, you know, I mentioned we have about 40 community wellness coordinators in our state, but there are 92 counties in our state. And our program is limited to working in places that have high populations of limited resource clients. So I'm sure there are places where 4-H'ers and 4-H families are living that I don't have staff working. And so we can provide them resources and help them be more aware of these sorts of things, like their share table programs at their schools. If those things don't exist, you know, start asking questions. Ask your school guidance counselor, ask the school nurse, ask somebody, hey, we don't have one of these. I know they exist and Purdue Extension's got resources. If I looked into this project, would we be able to do something like that in my school? That's a simple kind of first answer, I guess, I would give.
Yeah, that's a really good answer. I think that sometimes it just takes asking the question. So if you're a 4-H youth in a school and you think that a sharing table would be a great thing for you to have, then do, as Melissa said, talk to the food service director, talk to the principal, talk to the wellness committee, if you have a wellness committee, and see how you can implement that at your school. And it shouldn't even cost anything. So this is a very low to no cost solution that can have a really big impact and can be something that a 4-H youth can get involved and be the leader in. So that's a really good choice. Thanks for that information, Melissa. That's very eye-opening and important and great to know. Aside from healthy living, there's another mission area that we have, and that would be citizenship in 4-H. And so part of the citizenship mission area is helping 4-H members find ways to give back to their own communities. Today's topic lends itself very well to that service opportunity for 4-H. Again, Steve McKinley is with us. So Steve, what can you tell us about the effort for 4-H to take a bite out of hunger?
Well, Angie, several years ago, we started as a 4-H citizenship team across the state of Indiana of looking at ways that we could give back to our community, maybe on a little bit more organized basis. And so we did it. We started with the initiative of Indiana 4-H Takes a Bite Out of Hunger, and wasn't limited to just food insecurity or hunger issues, but that was our prime emphasis, and we continue to do that throughout the state of Indiana. And so there's a number of ways that our 4-H clubs, our 4-H members, our volunteers have been able to think about ways that they can address those food insecurity issues in their home communities. Many of our 4-H clubs in counties around the state have joined together and they've held food drives. And those food that they've been able to collect have been given back to their local food banks or their food pantries for distribution to families. And it's really been encouraging, I think, to see our Indiana 4-H family come together to really help meet some of the needs of their neighbors and their local communities.
It's really great to hear that 4-H is already involved, and then also to take some of the information that Melissa gave us and see all the ways that we can still be involved. So we've sort of started to chip away at the issue, and there's a lot more to do, and hopefully people will get that from the podcast today and come up with some ideas for their own communities. What can 4-H members and volunteers do in this upcoming year? What can they do as it relates to hunger and hunger issues?
As you mentioned, Angie, there's lots of options, and I think listening to this podcast is the first one, because we're educating ourselves, and the things that Melissa's been able to share over the last several minutes have wonderful ideas, and hopefully you've been paying close attention, 4-H members and volunteers, because there's a lot of really cool things in there that we as 4-H program can do across the state of Indiana. So first, trying to understand what the needs are, and we know that there is a need in Indiana. We know that there's likely going to be needs in our specific communities. So once you have this awareness raised, we really want to encourage our 4-H members, our 4-H volunteers to further explore what those food insecurity issues are in their local communities. What is the extent of that problem? What is being done currently to address the problem in your local communities? And then what can we do either individually or as a group of 4-H family, 4-H members, what can we do to help bridge that gap? And we've heard lots of great ideas. So we can get together as 4-H family, 4-H groups, be able to brainstorm some ways that we can address those issues.
So I think it's, we've talked about how individuals in communities can be helpful to our 4-H members. But why don't we talk a little bit about that some more? Just to reiterate, who are the people that we can go to in our communities that can help guide a 4-H member or a 4-H club or a volunteer?
Absolutely. And again, from what Melissa said, you've got your answer already, which is good. So we're going to recap just a little bit. But we hope that our 4-H members and their volunteers know who our 4-H Extension Educator is. And what you may not know is there are other educators in that office, too, that can be very helpful. And the first contact that I think I would make is talking with that Health and Human Science Educator. We call those HHS educators for short. Make an appointment to go in and talk to that individual and just see what's happening in the county related to specifically with the food insecurity and hunger issues. The educator for HHS may likely already have some programs in place that he or she is aware of, but also may be able to know some things happening in the community and some ways that that individual can direct us as 4-H members to find some different contacts throughout the community. And so certainly starting with HHS, we also mentioned the community wellness coordinators. We talked about others in the extension office that are working with the extension office to address these issues. So your HHS educator is one of those to talk with initially. While you're there, you might also want to make an appointment with the Ag and Natural Resource Educator, also known as ANR educators. In many of those cases, in many of our counties across the state of Indiana, the ANR educator is working very closely with the Master Gardener Volunteer Program. And those Master Gardeners know all things about growing produce, and many times have gardens already in place, or they have excellent skills and tips that they can provide about how to raise produce. And so you could work with them to start or enhance an existing community garden. Melissa talked about that too. That's ways that we can have a kind of a donor garden or be able to contribute back again to the community from this produce that has been raised specifically to go back to families who are in need in our local communities.
I think that's a good point about the Master Gardener program. And it's important to keep in mind that the Master Gardener program and the people involved with that can help you come up with ways to plant produce, even if you don't have a lot of land. So there are ways to plant produce in pots and in hay bales and all kinds of different ways. So you don't have to have a large plot of land in order to produce some food. And one tomato plant will produce lots of tomatoes. So it doesn't have to be that much or that many plants, I guess, in order for you to make a big impact. So those are great suggestions, and as well as the NEPs or the Nutrition Education Program, folks who are going to be in those county offices as well. So do you have any other suggestions for groups who want to take a bite out of hunger?
Our 4-H members, our 4-H volunteers are known for the creativity, I think. They are able to think outside the box better than many can. And so this is a good time to do that, to really think creatively, to do some good brainstorming, to meet together as a group and just kind of, again, think about what those needs are, where the gaps are, and what can we do? How can we really help make a difference as it relates to our community's needs to come through this food insecurity issue? Maybe we can challenge other 4-H groups within our community. There's clubs across the county, so maybe we want to do a little bit of a challenge for raising some funds or for growing some food or making contributions. We could work on that, we could work together. There's other community groups that have youth involved, and so maybe you work with some of the students that you're in school with or in other youth programs across the county. Again, finding ways that you might be able to partner with them to come on board with us. Maybe there's some schools that are interested in starting a backpack program, Angie, that you mentioned earlier. Maybe there's something like that that we could assist with. A couple of our counties I know are doing that very well across the state, and that's kind of an ongoing service opportunity for those 4-H clubs where they come in on a weeknight and they fill up all the backpacks that get distributed over the weekend, come back in the next week and do it all over again, and that provides a really wonderful service. There may be some local farmers in the community. They might be willing to set aside a portion of their cropland or of their garden area that they would be willing to contribute to this effort if you as a 4-H club would be willing to go out and do some maintenance. So there's a lot of weeding involved typically and some things like that to make sure that you're taking care of those vegetables and perhaps other things that you might be able to grow there. There's some counties in the state that have done some cool things with contests. We all like to compete. And so maybe there's ways that we can challenge a neighboring county. We can have a food drive between those two counties and see who can raise the most food. It's a fun way to really make a difference. And those donations will add up in a hurry. And so, you know, there's just lots of possibilities. We talk that this can be done throughout the year, and it certainly can. Nationwide, there is a 4-H True Leaders in Service campaign that happens in the month of April, specifically ends with the fourth Saturday in April with the National True Leaders in Service Day. And so activities that are being done with food insecurity or other activities would be wonderful things to focus on in April. Great time to start a garden, perhaps, if the weather holds. That might be a good way to get something kicked off that they would be able to, our 4-H members would be able to work on throughout the summer and into early fall. Again, lots and lots of possibilities. Our 4-H members are very creative, and I know that they can make a difference as we talk about taking a bite out of hunger.
Absolutely. I think these are amazing ideas. They all sound really great. And as you said, our 4-H volunteers and youth are very creative, so I'm sure they'll come up with some things that will just knock our socks off and amaze us. And we look forward to hearing what those are going to be. So do you have any final thoughts?
We want to share. We want to share what we do. And so we know we're going to do wonderful things. And so several years ago, again, we established an Indiana 4-H Citizenship Facebook page that allows our 4-H program to share some of the things that they're doing to serve around the state. And this does a couple of things. One, it lets us know what we're doing, and so we can share some of that impact statewide, but it also provides opportunities for us to learn from each other. And so an activity that might be done in Vandenberg County could be replicated up in Steuben County, a whole state away, 4 or 5 hours away, but they would still be able to learn from each other and share ideas back and forth. And so if you're willing to do some posts on our Indiana 4-H Citizenship Facebook page, you can tell us what it is that you've done, what you're working on. We love to see photos posted up there. If you have any statistics about number of people that were involved, about the number of pounds of food that were donated or cash donations that might have been made. Those are all different types of things that can be reported and will really go to show that we are taking a bite out of hunger, that we're making a difference, and most importantly, that we're helping our families, our friends, our neighbors, and our local communities to really get through a difficult time that they may be facing.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for that information, Steve. And thank you, Melissa, for the information that you provided to us as well. So now it's time for a call to action. How can you get involved in your community to combat food insecurity and hunger? Contact your local extension office and ask to speak to the HHS, 4-H, or A&R educators. Ask to speak to the NEP staff or the CWCs or community wellness coordinators that Melissa told us about. You could also ask to speak with your local master gardener. Find a food pantry or a food bank in your area and ask about volunteering your time. If you are in an Indiana 4-H club or are a 4-H club leader or volunteer in Indiana, consider inviting someone from one of these organizations to a club meeting. The knowledge and opportunities they will share will be invaluable to your members. If you are interested in additional resources, contact me at alfrost@purdue.edu for more information. And visit our Indiana 4-H Facebook page and tell us how you make a difference in your community. I hope you've been inspired to educate yourself, your family, and your 4-H club about food insecurity and hunger. Don't forget to pledge your health to better living by getting involved in your community. I'll leave you with a wonderful quote from Helen Keller that says, "I am only one, but still I am one. I cannot do everything, but still I can do something. And because I cannot do everything, I will not refuse to do something that I can do." Thanks for listening to this edition of the 4-H Podcast.